Thank you, Brother Bob. Brethren, it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you our first speaker of the convention, and that is Brother Tim Krupa. Unfortunately, Sister Dawn did not come with Brother Tim today, but as many of you know, the Krupas were members of the Los Angeles class at one time, and you know, whenever they pass by here, it's like having a family reunion. So we're pleased to have them. We're pleased to have Brother Tim with us today, serving us. Brother Tim has a very interesting topic for his talk, and it is entitled "The Mystery Epistle." The Mystery Epistle. Brother Tim Krupa.
Good morning. I haven't had the chance to get around and actually greet but a few of you this morning. So don't come up right now, but as soon as this is over, let's make sure we embrace. It's good to see you. It's good to be here. A side note to the LA class, we had kind of a surprise visit in December. We came through and we met with the brethren on that December Sunday, and we studied together a portion of Corinthians. And I want you to know that morning that we shared together still burns in my heart. That was, I don't know how else to say it, but for me, that was such a terrific meeting, and we were so energized and we were so focused that I can't forget it. So I want to thank you for that. I'm really sorry that Dawn's not here. We had some significant implosions in our couple small businesses that we have, and lost in some respects all of our employees, and we're recovering, but recovering is the operative word, not recovered. So she sends her love. We also meet with Sister Lorraine Trina, and she sends her greetings. One of the things that makes the absence of Dawn a little bit more of an issue for me is that this is our wedding anniversary. And it was 45 years ago today that we were married. It was the week before the Asilomar Convention. And I think there were, well, there's four of you out there who were at our wedding. And of course, Dawn was from the San Francisco area. I was from LA at the time, so we had to pick a neutral territory. Anyway, I better get going. One of the challenges with presenting something the first time, maybe a major challenge, is the timing. Okay, so I don't know how the timing's going to go through here. And when we get to a certain point in time, you may see that I have to flash through a whole bunch of slides to get to the main point, to get to the ending. So, let's start. To me, this is a little bit more like a fireside chat. I'm going to discuss some things from our studies up north and my personal studies. So, the mystery epistle. I apologize for the drama of the title, but this book of Hebrews has some significant mystery to it. And I think most of it comes maybe from the lack of definite authorship. There's nothing in the book that really pinpoints who wrote this. You know, and that's so different than most of the epistles, where it starts out right in verse 1 and it says, Paul and Timothy send you greetings. Paul and Titus. Paul and Silvanus. Those kinds of things. There's nothing here. Don't know whether it got clipped off or what, but it's just not there. Another part of the mystery is, don't exactly know who it was written to. It's very clear that it was written by a Jew to Jews, because he uses several times the expression, our ancestors. And he talks about Abraham or Moses or something like that. So that's clear. Generically, we know. Specifically, we don't. We're not really sure to whom, other than the Jewish audience. We don't, you know, there's two major possibilities. Most of the Jewish congregation was in Jerusalem. Okay, the other congregations, Rome, Ephesus, were all highly mixed. Not the Jerusalem class, the Jerusalem ecclesia of these Christians, nascent Christians, that was pretty much 100% Jewish. Now, the second city that's a possibility is the one in Egypt, Alexandria. Alexandria was a huge Jewish center of learning. They had libraries, they had Jewish libraries. You know, that's where they worked on the Septuagint translation many, many years before. So Alexandria is definitely a possibility that this letter went to. We might mention just briefly who some of the other possibilities are. In the early church, they tell us that nobody believed this was written by Paul. They said there wasn't a hint of any belief that this came from Paul's hand. Who were the top suspects? Well, Barnabas was one. Barnabas was from Cyprus, you know, the island in the Mediterranean. And Cyprus had a very strong cultural and political and economic connection with Alexandria. So there's some logic to the fact that Barnabas could have been connected to this group in Alexandria. Another possibility is Apollos. Now, Apollos was from Alexandria. He was extremely learned, and the people that are supposed to be experts on this, they say, if you look at the writing, this is a writing very different as far as its grammar, its structure, its logic. This is very different than any of the other epistles, especially the epistles by Paul. So it kind of fits. Apollos kind of fits. Somewhere around 300 Common Era AD, Origen said on this subject and on this question, who wrote it? He made the definitive ending statement, God only knows. So who wrote Hebrews? God only knows. But I think that you already believe from your studies, and we will confirm from this discussion, whoever wrote this was not only totally filled with the Spirit, but one huge dynamic force in God's work. Now, why was the letter written? Well, I think the first thing that we have to acknowledge is that letters were not just written because you didn't have anything else to do. Letters were almost always written because there was a problem. The letter to the Corinthians, or the letters to the Corinthians, were written because of specific problems. To the Galatians, specific problems. To the Romans, specific problems. This is no different. whatever group this was, they had specific problems. And as I looked at it, we kind of see the answers. You know, the author is saying, he's talking about this. Well, there must have been a question about that. And then there's the second one. And then there's the third one. So, here's the three major issues that I saw. Not to say that there weren't some small ones, but we're not going to get lost in the small or the minutiae. We want to see the big picture here. The first issue that was an extremely strong Jewish and in that time period religious and cultural issue had to do with angels. As I looked at some of the history here, you cannot believe the Jewish beliefs on angels. They believed that there were millions of angels. They believed that everything had an angel. The wind had angels. The crops had angels. Wheat had angel. Barley had angel. There was no end to the angels, and one rabbi even wrote down, every blade of grass has its angel. These people were obsessed with angels. The rabbis were supposed to have the answers to everything, right? You go to the rabbi, he's supposed to give you the answer. Well, if he got stuck, he says, it was an angel. That's who did it. So that became a huge part of their life. No matter what happened, they could explain it by the angels. The second thing that was an icon or an obsession in their religious culture was the high priest. There were good high priests and there were bad high priests. The high priest to the Jews was like the Pope to the Italians. Okay. They forgot about the bad ones and they basically worshiped. This was God's representative on earth. This was the man who had the Urim and the Thummim. This is the man who made decisions. He was the high priest. They loved his costume. They loved his breastplate. They loved the hat he wore. They loved everything about him. They were obsessed with the high priest. How did that fit with Jesus? Well, some of the Jews had a problem there because they didn't want that to go away. And you know, the problem with Jesus was, in their mind, he didn't come from the priestly tribe. That's a big problem. He wasn't a Levite. So that was in their mind. The third obsession that just permeated their hearts and their minds and their spirits was they loved the temple system. Now they loved the temple. Okay, the temple was one of the most extraordinary buildings on the face of the earth. I feel pretty comfortable saying it was the most extraordinary building. You know, originally designed by Solomon, then they rebuilt it, Zerubbabel. But then it was remodeled by Herod the Great. Herod had money. Herod had a real good architectural eye. He rebuilt the temple. He couldn't change the size because of the Jewish law and tradition. So he expanded around it. He built the courtyards. He built the colonnades. The courtyard was the size of 6 football fields. The courtyard could hold 1 million people. Have you ever seen 1 million people gathered together? Think Obama's inaugural. Do you remember that view? And there's a Washington Monument down the end. And there was this sea of people. All that on the Temple Mount. Yeah. They loved the temple. They were a suppressed people. They needed some icons to hold on to as to what was their heritage. They had the angels. They had the high priest. And they had the temple. And you know, they actually loved the temple system too. And we have to give them a little bit of credit here. They didn't have a lot of entertainment in those days. They didn't have movies. And the Jews didn't even have theater. Ah, but they had the temple. Oh, that was pageantry. They had music there. They had instruments. They had bands playing. All kinds of costumes. They would march in, march out. Smoke would go up. And they even had gore. I mean, bloody gore. They killed animals. Blood was running. This was exciting stuff. This was the temple system. And of course, they were tying the temple system to their relationship with God. Kill enough animals, and you could be good with God. So, the three major issues in the culture of the Jews, and the author of this book takes them all on. One at a time, he goes after the angels, he goes after the high priest, and he goes after the temple system. I'm tempted to stop right here. That's most of the book. That's virtually the first 11 chapters. Now, there's some side things in there. There's some very nice, good points. He starts to drop some hints, the author. Let me back up and review the chapters. See if I can find the chapter spot here. I'm not sure I can find it in my notes, but chapters 1 and 2 are about the angels. 3 through 8 is about the high priest. He brings in Melchizedek and that priesthood issue. And then 9, 10 is about the temple system. And the author says, Jesus' sacrifice destroyed that system. And he uses really strong language. Really strong language. In when he's talking about Moses, you know, Moses was pretty high in their psyche, wasn't he? Moses was pretty important. And he says, Moses did good things, but he acted like a servant. Now this, don't think that this letter was happily received. There's no way you can attack three of the major icons of their religious life, the angels, the high priest, and the temple sacrificing system. You can't attack those and expect the listener to be happy. I will probably say some things this morning that you're not going to be happy with. Okay. So, don't think for a moment that these people liked this. And here's the way he handled Moses. He says, Moses was a servant. Well, I'm sorry, servant. You know, in those days, they didn't use the word servant. What word was really there? Slave. Exactly. So he's saying, Moses was a slave. My goodness. Now, we can't relate to that very well because I was going to say we don't have servants, but I forgot I'm in Los Angeles. How many of you have servants in the household? Is it? Because we hear all kinds of things about Los Angeles and Hollywood. So maybe you still have servants down here. I don't know. No, I'm just kidding. Servants are gone. Slaves are gone. We have no idea emotionally what he's really saying there. If he said that to us, we don't know how to relate to that because we don't have servants, we don't have slaves. I thought of a word that I thought would fit close to Moses. Excuse me, but it's janitor. I feel the emotional impact of what the author is saying here is Moses was a janitor. That has a little more emotion to it, doesn't it? Because we know that janitors clean the toilets and clean the restrooms, and it's not a great job. Moses was a janitor. Christ was in charge of the entire building. Third chapter, verse 1. He says, he's dropping a hint here. Take a good look at Jesus. He is the centerpiece of everything we believe. That's the first hint as to where he's going. That's from the translation called The Message. I like it. Take a good, hard look at Jesus. He's the centerpiece of everything we believe. Another thing he says that is very powerful is in the 7th chapter and the 13th verse. Same translation. This is in the section about the high priest. And listen to this. There is no way of understanding this in terms of the old Levitical priesthood. Did you get that? There is no way, he's talking about this plan of salvation. He said, there is no way of understanding this in terms of the old Levitical priesthood. Hello? You know what he just said? He said, you can't study the book of Leviticus and figure out what's going to happen in God's plan. He's saying you can't look at Old Testament pictures and figure it out. He says there's no way of understanding this in terms of the old Levitical priesthood. I want to ask you a question. Potentially offensive. Do you believe in angels like the Jews believed in angels? Do you think that every piece of grass has an angel? Every blade of grass? All gazillion numbers of blades of grass have angels? Do you believe that? No. I don't think any of us even come close to that. All right. Number two question. About the high priest. Do you think the high priest, because he comes from the tribe of Levi, is on the same level as Jesus? Do you think that? No, see, they did. Okay, so you're like 0 for 2. All right, number 3. Do you think incidentally, the high priest doesn't even exist anymore? He's gone. There's a chief rabbi. I mean, they have different rabbis, chief rabbi of Great Britain, things like that. Chief rabbi of the United States, but they have a lot of factions now, so they all got chief rabbis. Number 3, do you think that the killing of animals is the way to salvation? Is there anybody here? I mean, I think you'd be new if you believe that. We don't believe that. We don't even come close to that. We don't even kill a dove so that we have blood. Zero. So what we just said is, very quickly, is you do not have any of the problems that group had. Sorry. What I'm saying is that most of what was written in those first 85% of this letter, most of it don't apply to you. Because we don't have the angel issue, we don't have the high priest issue, and we don't have the killing animals issue. So we hear it once, we got it. What about the other 15%? We actually, all we have left now is chapters 12 and chapter 13. Okay. I'm saying the first 11 chapters, interesting reading, definitely have some good points scattered in there. You can't beat 3:1 when it talks about Jesus. You can't beat 7:13, talks about the old system is dead. You can't beat those. But there's the 15% that's left has the ability to change your life. Here's how I think it works. First of all, we get input. I'm talking about input from God. Our input is based on the scriptures. That's why we come to meetings, get input. Number two, you have to remember it. All right? Remember, I've said before that we used to say, you are what you eat. And then we got smarter. Mrs. Lindbergh, she was a Los Angeles icon. She had health food stores. We used to go listen to her lectures. She said, no, you are what you digest. You can eat it. If you don't digest it, it doesn't do you any good. Okay, good. Good for Mrs. Lindbergh. I love it. But I heard something recently. It says, no, you are what you remember. You lose your memory, you are a different person. So that's why I'm always talking about memory and mnemonics and remember this and, you know, remember this mnemonic and the acronyms. We have to remember these things so that we can go to next step. Number three, if you don't remember it, you can't change your behavior. That's number three. You've got to change your behavior. And if you change your behavior, you can change your outcome. This is the process. This is why we're here. Now, if you don't change your behavior, what's your outcome? I'll tell you briefly. You're going to come back here in the general resurrection. Okay? No worry. You're going to come right back here on earth. But there, you have been invited, you have been made aware of another outcome. And that's to be part of the great administration, the educational system, the healing system, the medical system of the new age. You've been invited to have that part. So you can change the outcome. That can be your outcome. I think that's exciting. Don't you want to teach these poor people? Don't you want to heal these psychological issues that fill this world? Don't you want to heal the diseases? Absolutely. This is the process. Input. And you got to remember, then it affects your behavior, and you can change the outcome. So, what happens next after the first 11 chapters? Well, there's this marvelous, marvelous word, therefore. You say, well, whoops, wait a minute now. Hebrews 12:1 doesn't say therefore in my Bible. It says wherefore. Well, I'm telling you, it comes from the same root. It is pretty close to it's the same word. Emotionally, it's the same word. What is therefore? Why do we use therefore in language and in communication? Well, something, we create a logic. We have reasons. Something happens, We get a couple things together. We put them together, and they go in a direction, and we say, therefore, and we take an action. Okay? You study for the test. You study really hard. You go to all the classes. And you pass the test. Therefore, you graduate. You have a great job interview. And they like your background and all your references. Therefore, you get the job. You don't come to work for 4 days in a row. You mouth off to the boss. Therefore, you're unemployed. Okay. So, what happened here? Very briefly, the author says, the old system didn't work. Hello? The old system, angels, high priest, temple sacrifices, it didn't work. He says, you can't get there that way. That being the case, and he has sprinkled in all every one of those things, the sacrifice of Jesus. Therefore, this is what he says. This brilliant man, whoever wrote this, he says, keep your eyes on Jesus. Again, this is a great ending point. We could end right here. It's one of the most powerful scriptures in the entire Bible. It's verse number 2. Therefore is verse number 1. Also in verse number 2, I love this translation. He says, study how he did it. Okay? You got your instructions? This is it. Don't spend a lot of time on what was in those first 11 chapters. Don't spend a lot of time on angels and the high priest and all that lineage and the temple sacrifices looking for pictures and stuff. Don't do that. He says, keep your eyes on Jesus. And he says, study how he did it. I love the third verse in this translation. Go over that story again. Because you just said to me, I heard you, you said, you know, how many times do I have to go over that? I've been going over that since I was a kid in Sunday school. Yeah. Here's what he says. Go over it again. I could ask you all kinds of questions. I could give you a test. And we'd all flunk it because we don't study Jesus enough. What are we talking about? We're talking about studying the Gospels. Luke. You finish with Luke, you go to Matthew. Finish with Matthew, you go to John. You go to Mark. Then what you do? Well, you could go look at the New Testament and see what it says, the other letters say about those. But I start over again with Luke. Looking for patterns. What's in the 8th chapter of Luke? What demographic group is being talked to about in the 8th chapter of Luke? No answer. Interesting. Well, it's women. 8th chapter of Luke is women. I could go on asking you questions. I don't know if you'd pass or fail. But I'm convinced we don't study Jesus enough. And verse 3 again says, go over the story again, item by item. Now there's still the rest of the 12th chapter and the 13th chapter. And this is interesting to me. If you think about most of Paul's letters, he writes about an issue, And let's take Romans. He writes about an issue. He talks about the new paradigm that God is establishing through Jesus, and that it's through justification is by faith. He's establishing that. And then he comes to the 12th chapter in the first verse, and he says, what word? Therefore. Right? Romans 12:1. Now, did you see that Romans 12:1 and Hebrews 12:1 are the same basically word? You know how that happened? The angels did it. I don't know. That's okay. So, he says, therefore, and then the rest of Romans is a to-do list. What you're supposed to do to consecrate yourself, like he says in verses 1 and 2 in Romans. Right? He talks about using your talents. Talks about humility. He says respect for the elders. Taking care of other people. Hospitality. All those things in the rest of Romans. In Galatians, he deals with the issues of circumcision, and then he gives them a to-do list. This is what you're supposed to do. Ephesians, first three chapters, he talks about the history of how God wants to call and wants to have a family and is opening this up to us. And then the last three chapters are the to-do list. What you're supposed to do, it's your character changing. So many times Paul writes the introduction, the issue, the problem they were having, and then at the end he gives them the to-do list. This is so parallel in Hebrews. He's talked for 11 chapters about the issues, their failures, and why they were wrong, and now he's giving them a to-do list again. I tell you, I really have trouble not thinking that Paul wrote this, or that Paul had some huge influence in whoever wrote this. So, if you look at chapters 12 and 13, and this is your homework, I'm suggesting, I'm asking you, I'm begging you to pull out the action things to do. All right? Now, here's what's going to happen. There's going to be overlaps. Some words are going to be almost the same as another word. Okay, that doesn't matter. Just put them both down. I came up in those two chapters with 14 to-do items. Now, you know, I kind of like that. Because I've got chapter 12 and 13 is 14. So I can remember, I'm trying to remember 14 things from chapter 12. You get it? 12, 13, 14? 1, 2, 3, 12, 13, 14. Got it in my brain, helping me memorize it. All right. So I have the 14. Your list will be a little different than mine. Basically, they'll be the same. And then I divided it into three columns. One has to do with classical consecration issues. The other is a little bit more interpersonal relationships, so I call those the do's. And then there's four at the end that are don'ts. So I've got consecration, do's, and don'ts. 14 items. Five in one column, five next. Okay. Under consecration, number one is that, I'm repeating it again, what we just said, study Jesus. Then he tells us that you have to worship. He says God is pleased with worship. That means songs, that means meditations, all the things that are worship, gathering together. He says we have to witness. This is the phrase going outside the camp. Okay? Not just, this is to me is a behavior. Witness by your behavior. Jim Parkinson has a great phrase that I like. He says we should be witnessing all the time and once in a while even use words. This is not about just talking to people. This, the biggest witness is your life, not your words. Then he says, pray. Okay. And then he says, be thankful. To me, those five items are the core classic consecration things. Then, the do's, he says, get along with your fellow brethren. And you know, you have to smile here, because what he's telling us is, it's not that easy, right? If it was easy, he wouldn't have put it on the list. But he says, you have to work at getting along. Then there's a statement about being generous. And I put that like with hospitality. Remember the expression in Hebrews, hospitality to strangers even, because some have entertained angels. Okay, so as empathy, your feelings. He said, feel, in this particular scripture, feel for even the prisoners. Do you know anybody that's been in prison? How do you feel about them? Does it break your heart? Or are you in some sort of condescension thing? He really messed up. No, empathy. He says, feel for the abused. It's like a modern term there. And then there's two items of honoring. I used to think that honor and respect were the same. But you know, honor is a step above respect. I can respect the policeman, right? I don't particularly honor the policeman. But your spouse, give your spouse some honor. Give the elders, that's what he's talking about here. This is all in the 2nd, the 12th and the 13th chapter. And lastly, the don'ts. Don't get into self-pity. Don't be discontent with what you have, your situation. Oh, I used to be an elder, I'm out. I used to be the class secretary. I used to be the class treasurer. No, be content with where God has put you. Stay away from materialism. And he says, stay away from doctrinal speculation. Now, I didn't just throw that in at the end. Okay? That's his list. That's not my list. I can't wait to meet whoever wrote this book. Speculation would be anything that you don't have several, thus saith the Lord. And then this great man, led by the Holy Spirit, he ends it and he summarizes it. And this is, again, he says, we must get rid of every weight that's pulling us down. And he says, you have to run patiently, with endurance. It takes time. Just keep going. And then he says, the same phrase again, keep your eyes fixed on Jesus. That's the point of this mystery epistle. Keep your eyes fixed on Jesus. Get rid of every weight. There's a to-do list of 14, 15 items. That's how you know what to do. No excuses. You know, young kids come into school and they say, well, I didn't know what to do. You got the list. And if you can figure out that this comes down to keeping your eyes on Jesus, then this book will be no mystery to you. Thank you.